Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. Signals Wednesday, 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host, and I'm proud to be a part of the coolest team on the radio, Hank, Greg, Mary, Tatiana, and Nicole Rocherlin. Each week we captivate the power of story by bringing you remarkable tellers who take us on captivating journeys and then return us safely home. If you tuned in last week, you heard a number of new voices on our show. Hank Students hosted, and Tatiana moved over from the engineer's chair to the storyteller's chair and told a captivating story about the time she learned the importance of saying, "I'm sorry," and "I love you." Hank, that was a great show, wasn't it?
It really was, Warren, and I appreciate a minute just to thank everybody again. You know, while we were enjoying the Grand Slam last week, listening to you and Greg and some of our former guests, we had six of my students, seven including Tatiana, power through their collective nervousness to execute a great show. For us. They did it for us. And so a very special thank you again to Alo Soto and Cam Living for hosting in a seemingly effortless fashion the likes of four great student tellers, Ty Shundaya, I always mispronounce his name, Shay Tatum Hopper, Irene Nunez, and Tatiana Gago, of course, for playing double duty as exceptional storyteller in that very poignant story, which I know very well. And also playing wing person for Nicole, who I think performed like Leonard Bernstein. She'll have to look up and see who that is, but it's a compliment. Orchestrating the group with expertise, direction, and seasoned insight. You got to listen to last week's show for those of you who did not, because they represented us with aplomb. And frankly, they did much better than I ever expected. And my expectations are usually pretty high. So listen to last week's show. And again, God bless you all. I love them all. Students rock. They really do. And thank you guys.
And Tatiana, I just want you to know I loved your story about your mom.
Oh, thank you. It's really hard to tell.
Yeah, you did a good job. It was. I think a lot of people could resonate with that.
Oh, absolutely.
And the amazing stories continue. Tonight's four storytellers are from a storytelling group called Off Script, which formed in the Texas Medical Center 2 years ago. There's so many here, we're going to take them two at a time. And the first two are going to tell us their Hurricane Harvey stories. Dr. Joey Vachani is a pediatrician at Texas Children's Hospital and Baylor College of Medicine. She wants everyone to know she's a proud graduate of Rice University. Go Owls! I am too, by the way. And she loves to write, listen to podcasts, eat delicious food, and sing and dance with her two mighty girls, Avna and Dia. Pat Kelly was born in Alaska, raised in Cleveland, but hightailed it to Texas right after college. For the next 10 years, she worked at the Arts League of Houston and the Museum of Fine Arts, and then she moved into the medical center and worked at Baylor College of Medicine, first serving as coordinator of the Family Practice Residency Program. And small world here, she and I worked together 25 or so years ago in that department, and now she's assistant clinical coordinator for the physician assistant program. When she's not working in the medical center, Pat serves as a volunteer deputy voter registrar for the state of Texas, and her hobbies include sewing, visiting art exhibits, and tending to her feline housemates, Bubba and Missy, who just happen to be the lead characters in her Hurricane Harvey story. So Joey and Pat, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Well, we're delighted that you're here, and you've brought some of your friends as well. Joey, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about those mighty girls first. Are they listening tonight?
Yes. Shout out to Avni and Dia. I'm here, and they're listening, hopefully. They got on the radio, and they had a hard time finding the radio these days, but but they're
What's
excited.
That?
What's,
What's
that? The radio?
And I just got to say that the thing you told me when we met each other a few minutes ago,
yeah,
are the words you spoke to your husband the first time you met him.
Yeah, this was a pickup line between me and him when we first met, and it was, "So what's your story?" So I think it was irony and fate that brought me here today.
And it worked.
It did. It did. We celebrated 10 years in March.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah. That's great.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask you to tell your story in 1 minute. But before that, I'd like to know, I think our listeners to give us just a tiny background, what's a day like for you at Texas Children's Hospital?
Sure. So I'm a pediatric hospitalist, and so I see the children who are admitted to the hospital. They're the sick children, and a typical day is me either going to see the patients myself or with other resident learners, and we go and kind of talk with the families and the patients and create plans to really try to help them feel better and get better during their stay.
And then after work, what happens?
After work, I usually go and start picking up the children, and then we go home, have dinner. My girls really love to do some singing and dancing, so usually there's a dance party of some sort, and then baths and beds. So pretty typical, I think.
And do you work evenings and weekends?
We do sometimes. Our group, we're 24/7 in-house, so there are some evenings, some weekends, we definitely do that.
Well, I mean, I expected you to be tired and... You look very vibrant, and you've got a lot more energy than I do. So,
thank you.
With that background in mind, tell us your story.
Sure. My story is called Wait for Me to Come Home. Harvey arrived on Vivian Street in the morning, an uninvited guest thrusting his way into our red brick house with the white porch swing, my new Toyota Prius, and our lives. The night before the storm, we had a family hurricane ride-out party. We watched movies and all slept in our master bed, thinking there would be heavy rain, but nothing more. At 6:30 the next morning, my husband woke me up, and we frantically started moving things upstairs. It was almost noon when we had several feet of water on the first floor, with continued rain and water level rising. We saw a rescue team from our second-story window, had 30 seconds to get on their raft, and evacuated to a nearby church. After an 8-hour stay, where my husband stole Starburst candies to feed our two young children, we got drenched again while being taken by the National Guard jeeps to the convention center. From there, we ran in the rain to a nearby hotel around 10 p.m. I couldn't stop shaking after I got the girls to sleep that night. I kept thinking, how could this happen? They sat in wet clothes, slept without underwear, ate nothing but those stolen Starbursts that day, and were so blissful. Our little one made me laugh through tears when we finally got on the National Guard jeep shouting, "I love dancing in the rain," and singing Ed Sheeran's Photograph. Here's the chorus. "So you can keep me inside the pocket of your ripped jeans, holding me closer till our eyes meet. You won't ever be alone. Wait for me to come home." The next morning, I was crying at breakfast in the hotel. My 5-year-old ran up to me, hugged me, and said, "If you're happy, I'm happy." Later, when I asked what her favorite part of our previous day's adventure was, she said, "Spending time with my family." I've told my husband before how my older one is my soulmate. Cue husband's eye roll here. Meanwhile, the younger one kept making jokes and singing and kept us all laughing, our sweet, silly goose. Their imaginative play, ability to smile and laugh with only each other, and genuine desire to keep our family smiling set an example for all of us. And here's the irony. Rewind 12 years ago to August 29th. Hurricane Katrina ruined my childhood home in New Orleans. My parents evacuated last minute and were not allowed back for an entire month while standing water remained in our house, rotting away all of my childhood memories. I had just moved to a new city to start residency and flew them to be with me as we processed the shock as a family. This year, after Harvey, whenever I started losing faith, a crooked smile or sweet giggle from our goofballs proclaiming they were loving their hurricane gave me some perspective. I could either cry or laugh, even if it was forced, so why not try to smile? I posted Facebook updates to keep friends and family around the world informed and added, quote, "I especially enjoy Ryan Gosling memes if you really want to make me happy," end quote, to the end of one of my posts, and, well, you can guess what happened from there. My 17-year-old nephew even sent me one. How awkward that must have been for the poor kid. And yes, it made me smile. That is one handsome man. My husband and I also started making hashtag Harvey jokes with each other. He has always wanted an open floor plan, so I looked at him after our first floor was completely gutted and said, You got your wish. I don't particularly like driving, so my secret luxury desire in life, next to meeting Ryan Gosling, of course, is to have a private chauffeur, or at least a personal Uber driver. So naturally, when we lost my car, I told my husband, I got my wish. Another shock arrived on Halloween night. My father-in-law unexpectedly passed away. We found ourselves angry and bewildered all over again. One minute, we were reviewing blueprints to rebuild the house. The next, we were trying to compose an obituary. Our family urgently flew out of town to make funeral arrangements, fumbled through how to explain death to our little girls, and tried to understand how to move forward from such immense trauma, loss, and pain. But we did move forward, and we do move forward, step by step, day by day. We are blessed to have so many angels supporting and enveloping us with love. Our girl's teacher, who at that point was still unsure if her own car had flooded, stopped by the hotel after the hurricane with groceries, toys, and hugs. Our friends selflessly told us we could indefinitely use their rental before they had even come back to town to assess the damage to their own house. My work colleagues showed up with gloves, trash bags, muscle plower, and love to clean out my flooded house, had a meal train for our family for weeks, and took over many clinical shifts after the hurricane, and again after the death of my father-in-law, so I could attend the funeral. And then there's our biggest angel in the sky, my father-in-law, encouraging us along the way. Our family, Core Four, as we call ourselves, has had quite a journey this year, and we have a long road ahead. I'm trying to be gentle with myself and my loved ones, taking time to breathe, and looking to my mighty girls for strength. I think back to the night of the hurricane when we rode in the National Guard Jeep, all four of us drenched, hungry, and exhausted, and recall my young daughter's reaction, not one full of fear or frustration, but rather one of a joyful soul, dancing in the rain, happily singing, and enjoying the adventure. Our daughters have taught us so many lessons. To be resilient, remember to laugh, have a new appreciation for Starburst, be grateful for the incredible love and continuous support we have, and never forget, you won't ever be alone. Wait for me to come home.
Aww. So how are you and your family doing now?
We just moved back to our house about 5 weeks ago.
Oh, my goodness. So you were out for about 8 months?
Yeah, about seven months, yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So, but we're excited to be back.
Those girls are just role models for resilience.
They are. They're pretty amazing.
I was just thinking, I mean, until you got to the last line of the story, I was thinking the other title is Dancing in the Rain.
That is a good one.
Because that's what the girls were teaching you. It's just incredible.
Absolutely.
So to them, it was kind of cool, I guess, to get to ride in the National Guard Jeep.
Yeah. I mean, my little one, who's 4 and a half now, still talks about how she wants to do it again this year. And I'm just like, please no. Please no.
So you've been through Katrina and Harvey.
Yeah.
And you lost your family home in Katrina.
We lost the same thing, our first floor. And
yes.
And I was out for residency by that point. But all of our childhood photo albums and videos and all that stuff was downstairs. So it was quite a loss, especially for my parents, who had to evacuate last minute. But yeah.
Wow, that's a Gulf Coast saga that I'm not sure
I know.
People in other parts of the country fully appreciate.
Yeah, that's very true.
To have that happen twice. You've told me earlier that you had discovered storytelling to be a powerful tool both for expressing your emotions and for feeling them. And this story in particular has been cathartic for you.
Yes.
Just the process of writing the story, telling the story.
Yes, when I was younger, I used to write quite a bit. I journaled quite a bit. Almost every day I was writing in my little diary, which was just a 3-ring spiral notebook. After getting into medicine and just kind of studying and getting into a routine of seeing patients and doing family stuff, I just kind of had lost that. But I was really grateful for this avenue to just kind of share my thoughts. And it really helped me process. It really helped me get through this time.
So you journaled as a child?
Yeah. My five-year-old, well, now she's almost six, but my older daughter is doing the same thing now. So it's really
incredible.
Nice to see that. Yeah.
Well, you'll have to touch base with Hank in there. I think he has 40 books of journals.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
He journals every day for his whole life.
That's great.
Wow. I have to ask, those childhood journals, did they survive?
I don't think we have them anymore, but we might have a few. I think we have a couple.
Yeah. Say a little more about the title, Wait for Me to Come Home.
Sure. I think that, you know, I think I finally realized how much home means to me when we moved back. We had these things, and it wasn't the things, it was that space and just that feeling of kind of knowing where we were. And it was an incredible feeling that I had just kind of getting back into the house.
Right. What would you like our listeners to take from your story?
I think the story of the things about resilience and just kind of remembering other things that what's important and getting through. We all have people or things in our lives that kind of help us through the toughest times and the worst kind of moments in our life. And these seasons are going to continually happen, and we know that. And just kind of focusing on the values that pull us through, and that may be spiritual, that may be your children, that may be your family, that may be something else, but really kind of focusing on those things that get you through.
Right. And I'm guessing that your story, as traumatic as it is, you probably have a lot of colleagues who have similar stories.
Yes. We were talking earlier about how many of our colleagues had either biked over there or swam to get to work. So there was a whole group of people that were also separated from their families, not really knowing what was going on with them, getting to work to make the hospital run, to make the hospitals across this whole area run.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely.
I felt that was one of the untold stories that I hope somebody will tell. The hospital that I was working in at the time, many of the doctors and nurses literally swam to work.
They did.
I mean,
yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
I mean,
but I really saw this community and, you know, this Houston Strong hashtag or all those things that had come up. But I really saw this thing that, I mean, I was in such a sad place, but I was so much more grateful. And I think that gratitude, just kind of the gratitude and resilience are the two things I took with me from this whole experience.
Yeah. Well, your parents did a good job of instilling those in you. And I can tell that you've done that with your daughters
Thank
as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Joey. If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story here on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. You can catch us at 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and online at www.kpft.org, or, of course, on Facebook Live. My second guest is Pat Kelly, and she's got a flood story, too. Her story is, though, is about her cats to some extent. It's called Interloping Felines. And I think that's a theme that's going to resonate with a lot of listeners as well. Not only were we trying to help our children through this process, and in your case, your children were helping you. It's a really nice reciprocal process. But our cats and dogs also suffered, and it affected our relationships with them. And in Pat's case, I've got a feeling it affected your relationship with them for some time. How long have you been a cat lover, Pat?
Off and on. While I was growing up, we had a cat around the house, me and my sister, my two brothers. My mother really liked having a cat, but my father, as I recall, was not a big fan. I think he tolerated the cats because he knew they made the rest of us happy.
And why did they make you happy? What was it you think you liked about them?
Oh, they're just such soft and warm and sweet companions. They're just really nice to have around.
Yeah. We have a couple ourselves, but we have dogs too. Could you tell us about your job, your clinical coordinator for the physician assistant program? What does that mean?
I help the PA students get credentials for the clinical part of their training. Mm-hmm. This is when they go to clinics and hospitals and private medical practices and actually help the providers with the patient care. Mm-hmm. And when you're in your doctor's office and you see a trainee there, that trainee had to go through a lot of hoops to be allowed to be there. And I'm the one who helps them slice through all the paperwork and get the credentials that they need.
Yeah, and I know a lot of those people that you've helped with their rotations, and I know that your job description doesn't come close to describing all the things you do in terms of paperwork, personal support, everything from a mother to a sister.
That's it. I'm a shoulder for them to cry on and kind of tell them where to be every minute of every day.
Well, you do a great job.
Thank you.
Can you tell us your story? Interloping felines.
Interloping felines. I woke up on the morning of August 27, looked out my bedroom window, and where there used to be a parking lot, there was a lake. I walked downstairs and discovered that 8 inches of water, Harvey floodwater, had swamped the first floor of my two-story condo. I moved from the steps into the ankle-deep water, and I waded, barefoot and amazed, through the living room and the kitchen and into the dining room. The first thing I noticed was that the big coffee table art books on the bottom shelves of my bookcases were soaking wet. But the water seemed clean and clear. Under my bare toes, I could see the olive green ceramic tile perfectly. Almost immediately, there was a knock on my door, and a flock of young people, college students by the looks of them, were going from door to door to see if we, their neighbors, needed any help. Rain was pouring down on their smiling faces. Some of them wore ponchos, others were in jeans and shorts and t-shirts, and they were all soaked through to the skin. They offered to help me sweep the water out of my house, but by that time the water had receded on its own. So the kids moved on to the next unit, and I never saw them again. Later on, the water rose again, then receded again. And in the interim, I was standing in ankle-deep water at my kitchen stove, cooking scrambled eggs and sausage, oblivious to the danger.
Yeah.
It would be a long time before the extent of the damage that comes with floodwater would sink in. Just 2 days later, it was a gloriously sunny day, the kind of day that you want to spend every minute outside. And everybody was outside. Neighbors who had no flood damage were helping pull sodden carpet out of the units that had been flooded. Complete strangers were helping each other tote mattresses, sofas, and other furniture to the debris piles. My neighbor Ginger had bottles of cold water, those big 1-liter bottles, for anybody who asked or looked thirsty. The atmosphere of camaraderie was awesome. My cousins came to my house and brought armloads of moving boxes, and they helped me pack up all my stuff from downstairs and carry it upstairs to the second floor and to the attic. I didn't really realize how much artwork I had on my walls until they carefully removed it all, hauled it up the stairs, and stacked it in front of the bed in the guest bedroom. Moving always stinks, but moving with no advance notice is hell. My neighbor across the way, who had no damage to her house, packed a lunch for us and just delivered it to us, no questions asked, in a brown paper grocery bag. Turkey sandwiches, tuna salad, tortilla chips, oh, it never tasted so good. So the contractors came on Thursday and Friday, and they tore out the water-damaged flooring from everybody's place that got flooded. By then, I had returned to work, so I didn't see them cutting out the drywall and the insulation and the firewall that separated my condo from the neighbors on each side. They also ripped out the cabinets, the door frames, the baseboards, anything that got contaminated by the floodwater. since our building had not even a foot of flood water, the workers removed only the bottom 2 feet of the walls. So there was an open space 2 feet high in every wall on the first floor of our building. 10 townhomes, side by side, with all the side walls open. If you crouched down or got on your hands and knees, you could look all the way through from one end of the building to the other. In other words, we had no privacy whatsoever downstairs. But there was no reason to go downstairs because there was so much water damage down there. The only reason to spend time downstairs would be for me to microwave my meals. Then I'd carry my food upstairs and eat while sitting on the edge of my bed and watching TV. Everybody in the building was living upstairs, including all of our pets. Almost everybody in the building, including me, has at least one cat. The guy down at the end has a dog, but I never really saw his dog. But there would be nothing at all to stop a cat or a dog or any critter from walking through from one condo unit to another. Many times during those first 8 weeks, I'd come home, unlock my front door, and find a strange cat or two calmly walking through my gutted downstairs. Or they might dart away when they saw me coming. Or I'd spot a slow-moving critter out of the corner of my eye and realize, that's not my Bubba or my Missy. That's some alien animal from somewhere else. Twice I was awakened from a sound sleep in the middle of the night by my Siamese Bubba hissing and snarling at a neighbor's cat that had wandered into our house and come upstairs. Just nighttime rambling, just a cat being a cat. Then there was one time when I got home from work, climbed up the stairs, and found tufts of long white cat fur on the carpet in the hallway. I can only assume that Bubba was defending our territory and had a serious claw fight with the big, long-haired white and orange cat from next door. My mood varies a lot post-Harvey. Some days I feel totally stressed out and depressed by being forced to live in half a house. I mean, I really miss my kitchen. Other days, I feel grateful that I have an upstairs to live in, that my flood damage wasn't any worse. Grateful that the only personal items I had to discard were the playbills and photo albums that were on the bottom shelves of my bookcases. Grateful that the rescuers didn't have to pluck me off of my roof in a helicopter, that I didn't have to call the Cajun Navy to evacuate me by motorboat. Some days I feel like those cats who wandered into my house deserve to die. Other days I feel like the cats aren't to blame. They don't know that there's a line they're not supposed to cross. Sometimes I'd get out my water pistol and shoot at any feline that didn't live with me. Other times I just let the cats work it out among themselves.
Thank you, Pat. You've told a story from a perspective of your animals, and I found it rather intriguing. You said that you, first of all, you had half a house.
Yeah.
But yeah. Then you didn't have privacy. Which was worse?
Which was worse? I guess the privacy thing, you know, sometimes I'd be downstairs and I would overhear my neighbors, something going on at the neighbors on either side, or you could even hear sounds from two or three doors down, you know, and I don't know if people realized that everybody could hear what was going on. I guess the loss of privacy was worse, if you can say that.
Well, the way you describe sort of these quote invasions, an alien animal there, or you saw something that didn't fit, that you weren't used to seeing in your place.
Yep.
It seems a little scary.
Yeah, definitely.
What
especially
else might be getting
being
in here?
Waking up in the middle of the night, you know, by this an animal that just dared to walk up the stairs in my house, you know.
And what about people? I mean, I guess you trusted your neighbors.
Yeah, we had to. You had to trust your neighbors. I mean, it would have been kind of difficult for a human to get through the spaces because the studs were still there, you know, but it, you know, somebody who with, you know, enough initiative could have gotten through if they wanted to. Yeah. So, yeah, you had to really trust everybody who lives in the building.
Now, you wrote this story 6 months ago. Has your situation improved or changed?
Well, not much. I'm still living in half a house. There's still no running water downstairs. I'm still washing dishes in the bathtub. They did replace the firewall and the insulation and the drywall, so we did get our privacy back after about 8 weeks, but we're still a long way from being finished with the reconstruction.
Gee, that sounds
bad. I'm starting to feel like it's going to be this way forever, you know. Yeah.
It's like the new normal.
Right, right.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah.
How about your cats? How are they handling this?
They're getting along fine. They really don't have to see those interloping felines anymore now that the walls downstairs are intact. So they're doing great living upstairs. They're smart enough to know to just stay upstairs.
Yeah. And what would you like our listeners to take from your story?
I don't know. I guess I'd say that no matter how much we love our animals, sometimes you have to just let go and let them go where they want to and let them do what they want to do.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for sharing your story with us.
Sure.
I'm going to give our storytellers a little break here. We're going to check in with Tatiana and Nicole Rocherlin. What's going on in the wonderful world of Houston storytelling?
Well, Warren, first off, let's talk about the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild meets the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset for a story swap. You can come and just enjoy the stories, or you can tell a story of your own. And if you wish, they'll give you feedback. Things they liked and things they think that might make the story a little bit better. It's a small, friendly group, so the feedback is easy to take. And as always, helpful. And a big thank you, as always, to the Guild for not only being our sponsor, but for all they do to promote the art and craft of storytelling. Not the least of which is that they post all of our shows from the last 10 years on their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org. Click on the radio program tab, and you'll see the menu of all of our shows. Nicole?
Well, Tatiana, you know, everyone loves the Houston Storytellers Guild, and for some of you all, you know, the moth lovers are out there too. We know you're still basking with Greg and Warren in the fun and fellowship of last week's Grand Slam at the George R. Brown Convention Center. Because of that big event, the Moth's regular Story Slam will not be held on the usual date, which is the second Tuesday of the month, but it will be on Tuesday, May 22nd. And note the location as well. They're back to the regular venue, Warehouse Live. And this month's theme is ego. Stories about self-worth, lower high, overinflated, or just plain starved. You'll hear it from blowhards and wallflowers, narcissists, and self-doubters. I'm sorry, I'm getting excited. And let's not forget our show. Next week, Mary will be hosting, and her guests will be Matthew Hefty, author of A Hard and Heavy Thing, a war novel about the complicated inner lives of soldiers.
Thank you, Nicole Rocherlin. Thank you, Tatiana. Now back to this week's show. I'm here with Off Script, members of Off Script. It's a storytelling group that meets in the Texas Medical Center. And in the first half hour, we were treated to stories about the hurricane that rained down on Southeast Texas and flooded us with enough storytelling material to last a lifetime. And as Pat's story illustrated, it's still happening. It's still happening. I loved hearing those stories. They reminded me of how interconnected we are as families, as communities, as friends, as a community and as friends. And I hope that telling these stories is on some level therapeutic. It helps us all to process the trauma that we experienced as a community. So thank you for being vulnerable and sharing your flood stories with our listeners. Our next storyteller is going to talk about a different type of trauma, but first let's meet her. Holland Kaplan graduated from Texas A&M, go Aggies, and Baylor College of Medicine. And she's now finishing her first year of internal medicine residency in the Texas Medical Center. And when she's not working, Holland enjoys spending time with her wife. And unlike Pat, who's a cat lover, as you learned, Holland enjoys spending time with her dogs. I'm trying to set up a little tension here in the room. Dr. Holland Kaplan, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I gave Pat 6 minutes to talk about her cats, and I can't give you that long to talk about your dogs because you're telling a different story. But tell us, at least introduce our listeners to your dogs.
Sure. So we have two dogs, Padfoot and Sophie. Sophie's an older dog. She spends most of her time sleeping.
Sophie is one of my dog's names.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, no, she's an older dog. She spends most of her time sleeping, getting belly rubs. Padfoot is younger, more rambunctious. When we first got him, he ran into the apartment and sank his teeth into our coffee table leg. So he actually just got back from a 3-week sleepaway boot camp training. So he's been a challenge, but always keeps things interesting.
How do you spell his name?
Padfoot, like from Harry Potter.
Oh,
P-A-D-F-O-O-T,
sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. And on a slightly different note, you told me that your interest is particularly in medical ethics. Talk about that, how you got interested in that. What is it that appeals to you?
Sure. So my main interests are medical ethics and end-of-life care.
Yes.
I studied philosophy in undergrad. I've always kind of enjoyed asking questions and then trying to answer them, but never really being able to come up with an answer. And in terms of end-of-life care, I think for me, it ultimately, when I was thinking about this earlier today, it comes down to hearing people's stories for me. When people are at the end of life and they're having to make important decisions, a lot of times the best way that I can think of to try and help people make decisions is to hear their stories and to hear what's important to them. And for me, for my limited experience that I've had so far, it's always been very rewarding to be a part of that.
Wonderful. Now, your story has the most intriguing title, Painted Fingernails. Could you share your story with us?
Sure. So this story is from almost 3 years ago when I was a medical student, my first experience with a code. Code blue in shock room 2. Code blue in shock room 2, I heard announced over the intercom during my shift in the emergency center. I dropped what I was doing and ran towards the shock rooms. When I entered the room, CPR was already underway. I'd never seen a code before, and I was stunned when I saw the high-intensity chest compressions. Roughly 20 people were crowded around the bed, and a nurse was standing on a stool counting out compressions, 27, 28, 29, 30. The patient's chest recoiled like thick rubber each time, bouncing back as the nurse continued counting, 1, 2, 3, 4. I surveyed this girl, maybe 20 years old, while listening to one of the residents update an attending. She's had a lot of chronic medical problems since she was a kid. They're not sure exactly why she had this cardiac arrest. The girl's gown had been ripped off to make room for the chest compressions and placement of multiple intravenous lines. In response to an attending's hasty shout of, "Push epi now!" one of the nurses started pumping epinephrine into the girl's limp body. Her eyes, as the compressions continued, were open, but they had no life in them. Eventually, my eyes rested on the girl's fingernails. They were painted pink. Somehow, this made my throat catch. I was able to picture her painting her nails, maybe during a fun night with friends, trying a new color of nail polish, or getting a manicure. Maybe she had painted them last night. Maybe, less than 24 hours ago, she had been having fun with her friends, unaware that the next evening she would be surrounded by strangers. Some mechanically following a protocol to try to continue pumping blood to her brain. A few who had dutifully reported from other rooms to get in line to do chest compressions as others tired out. And many, many more who had slipped in after a coffee break to stand at the periphery of the room and simply gawk at the scene before them. A new nurse was standing on the stool doing compressions. "Everybody clear," shouted the attending. The nurses doing compressions, managing the patient's airway, and administering medications dramatically raised their hands in the air, indicating that they weren't touching the patient so that the shock could proceed. "Delivering shock," yelled the nurse as the patient's body jumped off of the bed a little bit as electricity shot through her body. The nurse immediately resumed compressions.
5 minutes later, the nurse conducting a pulse check declared that the patient had a pulse. The huge crowd that had gathered for the code, their curiosity satisfied, now trickled out of the room one by one. This girl, who had just stared death in the face, was now lying in the shock room with me, a third-year medical student, one nurse, and a plethora of bloody gauze, gloves, plastic wrappers, and empty medication bottles strewn on the floor. Flashing back to the CPR class from my first year of medical school, I realized that someone should probably be feeling her pulse, given that she had just coded and could lose it again. I walked over and gently placed my fingers on the patient's neck, relieved to find that she still had a strong pulse. But after several minutes, I felt her pulse start to fade. In the clinical setting, I've heard people often refer to, quote, thready pulses, but I'd never understood what it meant. Now I understood. Every time her femoral artery pulsed, it felt like there were tiny, thin threads of blood desperately, futilely pushing to get through, fighting to perfuse her brain. 30 seconds later, I was no longer able to feel even this thready pulse. Alarmed, I called to the nurse. Hey, she lost her pulse. We need to start compressions. I leapt up onto the stool. 1, 2, 3, I counted to myself, wide-eyed and terrified as I watched the patient's chest bounce back like rubber, but this time under my hands. Again, remembering my CPR class, I continued compressions, thinking to myself, at least 2 inches deep, 100 compressions per minute, come slightly off the chest after each compression to allow the heart to fill. I was trying not to panic. After a few more seconds, I heard fast, frantic footsteps as a herd of people stampeded back into the room. Keep up the compressions, faster, shouted the attending, who had just walked in. He continued to stand at the foot of the bed, arms crossed, barking orders. A few seconds later, the mother of the patient, her face streaked with tears, ran into the room and yelled, "Stop hurting her! Stop everything!" I held my breath as I turned towards her, but kept doing compressions. Should I listen to the attending physician with years of medical experience who told me to continue, or to the mother who was watching me break the ribs of her dying daughter who told me to stop? Did my duty to the patient and her mother trump my obligation to follow the orders of my attending? Thankfully, 2 seconds later, the attending saved me from having to make this decision and announced authoritatively, "Stop compressions." I stopped compressions and stepped down from the stool. The girl's mother was now wailing, "Please, Jesus, don't take her away from me." I placed my fingers on the patient's neck and miraculously felt a pulse as the mother loudly wept at the bedside. As I became acutely aware of my own blood pounding through my arteries, I stood there with my hand on this woman's neck for the next 10 minutes and felt the life literally drain out of her. The blood gradually went from a strong, pulsating flow to a weak, thready trickle. Even if she survived, how long had her brain gone without perfusion? What would her life be like if she ever had blood spontaneously pulsing through her arteries again? Would she ever be able to paint her nails? When I looked up, I realized I was one of only 3 people remaining in the room. I took my hand off of the girl's neck and quietly left the room, not wanting to make the weeping mother feel like I was treating the last moments of her daughter's life as a spectacle. I numbly walked over to the computer in the main area of the emergency center that I had been sitting at before the code. I sat there, blankly staring at the screen and aimlessly clicking things to appear busy and avoid questioning. 10 minutes later, I went back to the shock room. As I approached, I noticed a crumpled fragment of brown paper towel taped to the door. I looked closer and saw scrawled on the paper in red marker, "Do not enter." I recognized the resident who had been in the room with me, typing at the computer outside the shock room, and slowly walked up to her. "What happened?" I asked, gesturing towards the shock room. "She died a few minutes ago," the resident said somberly, briefly looking up at me before returning to her typing. I stopped breathing and felt my face start to warm up. This was not unexpected, but somehow I still hadn't prepared myself for it. Disoriented, I walked over to the empty resident lounge, closed the door, leaned against the wall, and started crying. I didn't even know the girl's name. I didn't know what she did for a living, if she was still in school, what sports she played, or what music she listened to. Despite knowing nothing about her life, I somehow still ended up being one of the few people at her bedside as it ended. It was a privilege I hadn't earned, that I felt I had no right to. There are a lot of questions from that night that I will never have answers to. Why did this girl, who was merely a few years younger than me, have to die like this? Why did I have to be the person doing compressions when the girl's mother ran in? What had she been doing the night before, the last night of her life? While I may never have answers to these questions, I do know that I will never forget her pink, painted fingernails.
Oh, my. That's a powerful story. You take us through, one of the things that makes it so powerful to me is that you take us through the emotions as well as the work that you're doing. You're trying technically to remember how to do the procedure properly, but at the same time you're watching someone die and you're touching someone who's dying, and you're trying to manage those emotions from panic to crying.
Yeah, when I first wrote this, and it was a little bit messier because it was therapeutic for me, when I looked back and read it, I noticed that I was kind of switching between referring to the girl as the girl and as the patient. And so
right.
I think I had that kind of dynamic going, confusion within me of, is she a patient? Is she, what is uh-huh. she? And I think that was one of the challenges.
This struggle between, part of you, I guess, needs to objectify her in some sense so that you can do the procedures properly. But you're also a human being, roughly the same age?
At that time, yeah.
And so you've got to be faithful and true to your feelings as well. You can't deny that.
Yeah.
How have your perspectives changed since this experience?
So I think since that experience, since I've had a little bit more experience, I've gotten a little bit better at compartmentalizing my emotions and being able to kind of provide medical care and then deal with the emotions later. I think the challenging part is always figuring out how to deal with those emotions later, and that's something that I imagine I'll be trying to figure out for a long time, how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a process that takes a lifetime. It evolves, I think. And it gives me hope when I hear young physicians and nurses who are struggling with these issues in such a thoughtful way. Real quickly, one more quick question. How does CPR and resuscitation differ between real life and television? Because most of our listeners know it through television.
Sure. Well, I think that on TV, a lot of times what happens is... you know, you get one shock, you do a couple of compressions, and the patient kind of wakes up and walks out of the room. I wish with all my heart and soul that that's what happened in real life. Unfortunately, it can be a lot more challenging to bring a patient back and help them maintain kind of a good quality of life after a horrible event like that happens.
Yeah. Thank you. This is So What's Your Story on Pacifica 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. Holland Kaplan has just told us this amazing story about how hard it is to face death. And I think that's true for all of us, whether we're doctors or nurses or just regular civilians. And I think all of our listeners were feeling for you and with you through that process, the emotional pain, the spiritual pain. And now I'm going to bring in our fourth guest, Dr. Andrew Childress, who also has a lot of experience in this area. He's a clinical ethicist at Methodist Hospital, and he also teaches medical ethics at Baylor College of Medicine. And, important for our purposes, he's the one who organized the off-script group, the group that's here tonight. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here. And I just want to point out that it wasn't just me who organized it. I was part of it, but it wasn't just me. It's a team effort.
Good. Okay. And I'm hoping we can have other members of the team back in the future and get to know all of you, because I'm just thrilled that you're doing this.
That would be fantastic.
Tell our listeners, before we talk about off script, just a question about clinical ethics. What does a clinical ethicist do?
Sure. Well, it's actually really fortunate that Holland told her story today, because it gives a kind of perfect example of an ethical issue. So imagine in Holland's story that the mother came in, instead of saying stop everything, she said keep going. Mm-hmm. And then you have a conflict between the mom and the medical team, who at that point was thinking maybe we shouldn't keep doing this because she's not benefiting. Mm-hmm. So there you have an ethical crisis, and I can imagine the resident or the attending or somebody stepping out of the room and calling our service and saying, listen, we're we're actively coding this individual. We need some guidance about what to do. What should we do in this instance? That's an ethical issue. We'd come in, we'd talk to the mom, we'd talk to the care team. We try to get a sense, as Holland was saying, of who this person is and how does advanced life support therapy, the CPR, fit within her goals and values. So we would try to mediate that conflict by getting a sense of who this person is. And that's what I really like about clinical ethics, is I get a chance to learn patients' stories. Mm-hmm. I walk into a room, and that's essentially my task, is to learn who the patient is, what their values are, and how those map on to treatment options and medical care.
Well, speaking as a family member of those who have benefited from the services of clinical ethicists, who've had to make these difficult decisions in consultation with the doctors and you all, what you do is extremely important. It's, as Holland's story indicated, it's such a tumultuous moment when this happens. And to have someone kind of coordinate the decision-making process is very important.
Right. And we're kind of an impartial, you know, outsider. We can provide guidance without being as, you know, emotionally involved as the team is, or as the, you know, as the families are, right, and the patients are. We can just kind of, you know, help move the situation forward and provide an ethically appropriate, you know, resolution, hopefully.
Yes. And now, given the caveat that you did not start the off-script group completely by yourself, I appreciate your modesty there and your collegiality, I guess. Tell us about the group, a little bit about how it was formed, what it does, that kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah. So the whole idea for Offscript started as a conversation among our colleagues about how to bring kind of the elements of other storytelling events like the Medical Moth, or like the Moth, and StoryCorps,
yeah,
and focus in on the real life experiences of doctors and nurses and patients and researchers, and kind of provide a forum for sharing those insights with a broader audience and with them, you know, with the medical community at large. So that was the idea. We started off. So the process, the way it works for us is we set up a theme, we send out a call for stories. We try to find stories that match the theme and the format of the event, and we you know, go through that selection process. Once we've made our selections, we have our off-script storytellers go through a workshop where we focus on writing and the craft and the performance aspects of their story. And then a day before the performance, we have them rehearse to kind of fine-tune some of the performance aspects, work on enunciation and projection. They all do a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. And then the next day they get to perform in front of about 40 or 50 folks, some of them their closest friends, some, you know, colleagues from the medical center.
That's incredible. I know I've had some experience with the Moth, and until I got involved, I didn't realize, but that's what they do. There's a very... with some of their programs, there's a very intense directing process. And I thought when I got involved at first, it was just, well, you just show up and tell your story. But in some of their, you know, more advanced events, they do a tremendous amount of working with you to really figure out what it is you really want to say. And it's hard work because you have to dig deep. And right. So I think that's great that you do that. It's quite a resource to offer that. Do people respond well to feedback?
I don't know. What do you guys think? I think you respond pretty well.
Yeah.
You guys are very polite, at least to us, when we provide feedback.
I think the editing process was good because you want to have all these details. I think the editing process was good because you want to have all these details, and maybe you don't need those details. Mm-hmm. So for my story, we kind of focused on other parts of it, and it was still true to the story, but mm-hmm. it was really nice to have that feedback, so I appreciated it.
Yeah. Me too. I really enjoyed the process of collaborating with all the other writers and just helping each other dissect their stories and you know, move this sentence to the end of the paragraph or use this word instead of that word or take out this whole section. Mm-hmm. It was painful, but it was fun also. Yeah.
For me, it was really impactful to kind of get some pointers on performing what I had written, because most of what I write or have written in the past is kind of therapeutic for me, and it's not written for anybody mm-hmm. else. And so experience of kind of getting feedback from other people and learning how to perform what I'd written was great.
That's great to hear that.
I think, you know, stories are what patients tell you all. But now you're telling your stories to your colleagues. Mm-hmm. I think that's a powerful process. Mm-hmm. We've got like 30 seconds. Any other comments about what draws you to storytelling or what you like about storytelling?
I think the power of feeling a togetherness that we're different, but we're also similar. And we have so many of the feelings that I hear today. And when I listen to stories, I just feel like I'm going through that myself. Mm. It's really amazing.
That's a great way to wrap up this wonderful hour. It's hard to believe, but we are out of time. This has been the fastest hour in the history of radio, I promise you. Joy Vachani, Pat Kelly, Holland Kaplan, and Andrew Childress, you shared your stories of trauma, from the rising floods of Hurricane Harvey and Katrina to the painted fingernails of a dying, I said woman in my little notes here, but young woman, we'll say, girl. Your stories taught us lessons about resilience, about families in crisis, about pulling together and being held apart, about fighting for life and also accepting death, about relationships and values and all those things that matter most. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
And will you come back?
Sure. I'd love to.
In honor of your stories, we're going to go off the air tonight to the tune of one of my favorite songs, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, by, of course, Bob Dylan. It's a song that reminds us that, well, you listen, you decide. And don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are waiting in the wings to share their cool classics. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman and the entire So What's Your Story team, reminding you that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
I've heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you meet, my blue-eyed son? And who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there. Get even more.